The Marion Finucane Show on RTE Radio 1 with Hyundai. Now offering 5 years free servicing on every new 142 Hyundai, Ireland's fastest growing car brand.
Now, with me in studio this morning are Colm O'Gorman, Executive Director of Amnesty International Ireland, Yankee Fackler, Corporate Trainer and Historian, Chair of Jewish Historical Society of Ireland, Ursula Tipp, Founding Partner of Tipp McKnight Solicitors, Colonel Colm Doyle, retired Irish Colonel, and Deirdre de Barca, Director of Advocacy and Justice for Children with World Vision's Brussels office. And you're all very, very welcome indeed. Now, I suppose, given the stories that are in it, widespread coverage of what's happening in Gaza. Jean Kerrigan, we have no opinion. Then there's another astonishing story that says, be grateful you lost just five, 14 of mine are gone. Truly terrible stories. Can I start with you, Colm Doyle, and this? I presume that you served in Lebanon and would be very familiar with the area.
Yeah, I served in Lebanon on a few occasions, mm-hmm. and I've been to Gaza, but a long time ago.
Yeah.
It's a dreadful situation, and I know I was sitting in this chair about 4 years ago when we were discussing the same thing happened before when Israel went into Gaza.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a repeat of what has happened before. There are two sides, totally intransigence, following their own whatever travels that they want to do. But certainly I think the situation at the moment is really, really desperate.
What do you think of the coverage? Was there anything that you picked out?
Well, not particularly, except, you know, what a thing that struck me in the other day, in fact, was the Irish Times to get the reaction of the Israeli ambassador to Ireland on the attempt by the United Nations to have an investigation.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, some of the comments he passed about the United Nations were truly not that something you would have heard, I believe, from an ambassador, he called it, supporting terrorism. So it depends on what side of the fence you are on. There is fault on both sides, but this is a war that is reaching very high proportions, and the loss of life is quite dreadful.
Yankee, given your own personal background, mm-hmm. I know that you lost your grandparents in the Holocaust and that you have a son in Israel at the moment. Two things. First of all, your own analysis of what is happening, but also how you think the coverage is here.
Well, let me start with the coverage. I think it's inevitable that when you get a terrible count of people dying, that is going to grab the headlines as it has done. But I think that one of the problems with numbers, like with the numbers game, is that there's not very much analysis that I've seen across the papers, not now and not in the last couple of weeks, real analysis as to what's actually behind it, as opposed to this is what happened today and this is how many rockets Hamas fired, this is how many rockets or missiles Israel fired. And I think that gets very lost.
Well, there is also coverage of how many people were killed.
Oh, I'm saying that, yes. That's what's grabbing the headlines. And, you know, I, like anybody else, the numbers are horrific, and I grieve for every death in Gaza. It doesn't give anybody, not me and not anybody I know, any pleasure to know that anyone is dying there. But what I'm saying is that in terms of you asked me about the coverage.
Yes.
There's no analysis or very little analysis. It just seems to be describing the horrific scenes, and they are. There's no one is denying that the pictures that we see and the reports that we hear, that they're happening. I don't see much analysis as to how it happened, why it happened, what could have stopped it, and what could stop it.
I remember doing an interview with a woman some years ago, and she was involved in advising the Israeli government and indeed the Palestinians, presumably with a view to peace. And she made the point that the whole purpose of Israel after the Second World War and the Holocaust, which, you know, Europe, it all happened in Europe, was that the Jewish people would feel safe. but that the policies being pursued by the Israeli government were in fact having the exact opposite effect on the Israeli citizens.
Okay. I mean, I would totally disagree with that analysis. But I think it is instructive, because going back to your first question, I'm very conscious, of course, of my grandparents having been murdered in the Holocaust. And I'm now very conscious, as a private Israeli living in Ireland, and coming to Ireland because I fell in love with an Irish lass, I'm very conscious of my grandchildren, for the first time in their young lives, having to run with a few seconds warning into bomb shelters, hearing explosions, sirens, something that I never dreamt that they would ever have to do. In terms of trying to understand what's going on both sides, and you mentioned this woman who was interested in both sides, just yesterday I was talking to my daughter-in-law in Israel. And on the one hand, she's very, very upset about what is happening with her children. And on the other hand, she's trying to fundraise for a program that will bring the kids in the school where my grandchildren go, together with Arab children in Nazareth who go to an Arab school. So that's the situation out there. In Israel, people are not, from my experience, living there for many, many years and being here for many years, Israelis don't hate anyone. Israelis don't want to see, when I say Israelis, I mean the people in the street. And it's a democracy with right wing, left wing, and everything in between. You don't feel hate. You feel
fear?
You know something? Certainly you feel fear when you can't see the enemy. When you've got an army against an army, you can say, okay, let's hope our army is okay.
No, but if you take the wall, and the wall, I remember being absolutely shocked when I saw that wall, even though I had seen photographs of it, because it makes the Berlin Wall look like a toy.
That wall, or it's a fence that's 3% wall, but that was built very specifically because of the suicide bombings, where hundreds and hundreds of people, I used to live in Tel Aviv, and around me, literally around me, in a radius of a mile, three bombs, suicide bombs, went off, killing 50, 60 people altogether. So we had to live with that because there wasn't much choice. That partition barrier, no matter which way you look at it, it saved hundreds of lives because they stopped coming. Now, is it nice? No. Does it look nice? No. Is it a good idea? No. Is it necessary? Yes.
But it also has destroyed lives for Palestinians, just in terms of farming, getting to jobs, trying to get in and out of Jerusalem.
You know, Marion, there are no winners in this. I think everyone is a loser.
Well,
I think on both sides, everyone is a loser. As soon as there is violence, everyone loses. There's no victory.
Okay, Colin McGorman.
You know, I think some of the most shocking things to consider about the current conflict, and I agree in many ways that the lack of analysis of the ongoing situation in Israel and the occupied Palestinian territories in between these bouts of really horrific conflict is a huge issue. And the world needs to focus a lot more attention on resolving the intractable problems that have existed for decades. However, let's talk about what's happening. You have a population of about 1.7, 1.8 million people corralled, unable to leave a territory that's about 1/12 the size of County Tipperary. Gaza could fit into Tipperary 12 times. And right now those people are being subjected to never-ending barrages and assaults of artillery, shell fire, drone attacks, and tank weaponry being fired against them. 1,000 people have now died in Gaza. More than 6,000 have been injured. In Israel, 40 soldiers and 3 civilians, including one Thai worker, have been killed, and over 300 soldiers injured. Both sides in this conflict are undoubtedly, there's a prima facie case that both sides are responsible for very grave and serious war crimes. There is no possible way that Israel can carry out the kind of military offensive that it's carrying out on Gaza without the very grave risk of committing war crimes. We're talking about
What's the solution, though, Colm?
Well, one of the solutions...
Gene Kerrigan was writing today, and he was very cross that we abstained in that United Nations vote. And he was talking about the rockets from Gaza and the capability of the Israelis to divert them. Fact of the matter is, in any country, even if they're only tin buckets that are being sent over to explode, people don't like having things shot at them.
And Israel
now,
has...
Now, there's proportionality,
exactly,
I know.
Exactly, and that's the point. Israel has an absolute right to defend itself, and actually it has a responsibility to defend its citizens. But it has other obligations under international humanitarian law to carry out the defence of its own citizens in a particular way, and
how?
That it's in very significant breach of.
How?
It cannot indiscriminately target a civilian population. It must take exhaustive, extensive efforts to avoid inflicting harm on civilian property and on civilians. Nobody could argue with any credibility that's an obligation that Israel is currently fulfilling. You ask what were some of the solutions. Well, from our perspective, one of the key solutions is an end to impunity. I mean, those responsible for these kinds of war crimes must be held accountable on both sides. And that's why for the last number of weeks, Amnesty International has been pressing and supporting calls within the United Nations Human Rights Council for a UN-mandated commission investigation to investigate war crimes by both parties to the conflict. I have to say that, you know, whilst I read the explanation for the EU abstention from the vote, and it would have been better had the resolution that came about forming the vote named explicitly violations by Hamas and other armed Palestinian groups. There's nothing in the mandate of the Commission that will not allow it to investigate violations on both sides. So this Commission must and will and should investigate alleged war crimes that were committed by either armed Palestinian groups and Hamas, but also clearly by Israel. Okay. That needs to happen, and there needs to be prosecutions on foot of those war crimes. So that commission is due to report, I think, in March of 2015. We would hope to see that this report will make clear recommendations to both sides in the conflict, but also bring forward proposals for how there will be prosecutions for any findings or findings of war crimes to either side in this conflict. Because if not, in 5 years' time, we're very likely to be back here again.
Yeah. That we've already been there three times.
Absolutely. I mean, the last time, 2008, 2009, CAS led, was when we were talking about, we had just, I think we were about a week or two into it and we went over 1,000. We're facing the same kind of onslaught at the moment and the same kind of figures.
Yeah, and I'll come back to you in a second, Yankee. I mean, I know that the figures are completely incomparable to, say, Northern Ireland, but both sides are generating hatred and fear that's transgenerational, you know, and that goes through. It's not working.
What this is going to cause a new generation of Palestinian, a great degree of hatred against Israel for decades to come. It did it 10 years ago. It's doing the very, very same. And you can take the points on both sides. Israel will say, here is an organization called Hamas, which is representing the Palestinians, that have declared war on Israel. It does not recognize us as a sovereign state. And it says, we are out to destroy you. We need to defend ourselves. But that cannot give the right of the Israelis to carpet a small city with the amount of munitions that they have done.
And How do you do it?
Well, you don't do it by bombing blanket over schools, hospitals.
But if you take the concept of Tipperary, it would seem to me that anything that would come from the Israeli side into Gaza is inevitably going to.
But the Israelis know
because
this.
It's too crowded.
Of course.
So what are they meant to do? Could I just make a quick point here?
Sure.
I think it's really important. I work for a child rights organisation, and if we look at the death toll in Gaza so far, 1,000 approximately, or over 1,000 Palestinians killed, and out of those 150 children approximately killed. You know, this whole escalation violence began with the murder of three young Israeli Jewish teenagers, and then there was a reprisal, apparent reprisal murder of a young Palestinian teenager. you know, we have to look at, we all have a vested interest in international humanitarian law being upheld, because if it's not, all of us, you know, we don't know what in the future what kind of situations we'll find ourselves in. But we do know if there's a code of conduct that's internationally mandated, that has international support, whereby if there are situations of war, that particular populations in particular are protected, that children in residential areas, that particular civilian infrastructure is not targeted in situations of war, unless there's absolute justification for it. That does not seem to have happened at the moment in terms of the shelling, the massive bombardment of Gaza. And it is shocking to look at those figures and to see the images of young children, of mothers having lost their children, of families have been absolutely, you know, devastated by the number of family members that they've lost. I think we need to look at this issue. And for me, it is extremely disappointing that Ireland abstained on this vote in the UN Human Rights Council. Yes, there was obviously a case to be made for a coordinated European position, but Ireland has always been very sympathetic to the fact that the Palestinians are in a disempowered situation when you look at economically, militarily, politically, and landwise.
Yeah.
And so I think that, you know, it was very disappointing to see Ireland. I think its UN, its ambassador, the Irish ambassador to the UN, made a very strong statement, very clear on where Ireland stood. And yet when it came to the vote that Ireland abstained, I think it is not reflecting public opinion. I think from anybody I have talked to, it certainly does not reflect the opinion of the Irish people, the vote, the abstention. And I think we really do need to think about, is it in all of our interests that international humanitarian law is upheld? And can an inquiry do any harm, or can it just establish the facts? And I think we really do need to see if we can't take a stance on this situation now in Gaza and establish exactly what crimes have been committed, then we do have no right to stand up in any other situation, whether it's Syria or Ukraine or anywhere else, and say war crimes are being committed or, you know, human rights violations.
Well, neither Europe nor Ireland has a great record on those, let it be said, either. No. Varsley, you haven't got in here yet.
Okay, one thing maybe I start, just because you asked earlier about the reporting in the papers about it, if it was balanced or stuff. I think today in the Sunday Times, there's one article which I liked. It came from in two dispatches from the Middle East, a Sunday Times journalist and a Gazan writer and professor reveal the different fears of civilians. So I like that because, you know, the way it gives a little bit of the view of the people in Gaza, and the article is subscribed, "We wait each night for death to knock at the door." Okay, and then it gives, but also the problems the Israeli face, and there's Eldar, an 18-year-old who's now going to be a soldier, you know, and with 18, that's very young, and all the problems that brings. So I do think, as my previous speakers have said, there is no winner in this. You know, that's important, I think. The suffering is on both sides.
Yes.
But one thing which I think has to happen now, there has to be a real solution, because this problem is now ongoing for decades. That's
well,
the thing.
It goes back to 48, essentially.
Yes, it does, yes, yes.
You say not so.
No, the particular problem in Gaza, I'm not talking about the Palestinians in Gaza and the West Bank. Gaza, I mean, I think we have to make a distinction between the people of Gaza and Hamas, which is a terrorist organization, whichever way you
but
look at it.
But they voted for them.
Did they vote?
Democracy.
Yes.
And we want democracy until we don't like the result.
But did they vote for a government that was going to indiscriminately fire rockets into Israel for years? This is not. Didn't start this week, didn't start last week. Thousands of rockets a year. And most of the time, Israel sort of doesn't retaliate because it hopes that it's going to diminish and people are going to see sense.
Yes, but Yankee,
when
you say to me it doesn't go back to 48...
Gaza doesn't.
But the whole issue of land... And I remember doing a programme myself in Lebanon with some of the people in the refugee camps. And it was after Israel had withdrawn from Lebanon. And they were Palestinian refugees, obviously. And they were bringing their children and their grandchildren down to the border to show them the land that had been theirs. And that's an historical fact. And Europe agreed on it and the United Nations agreed on it because after the Holocaust, it was necessary that there was a place of safety for Jewish people.
That's very simplistic, because the move to have a Jewish state started 100 years earlier.
Yes.
1947, United Nations recommended two states. They didn't have the power to create a state. They recommended two states, Jewish state, Arab state, in 1947. The Jews said, yes, we'll take the strange-looking piece of land that you've recommended for us. And I don't think there were very many Palestinian spokespeople at the time, but the Arab states said for them, no, we're not going to have a state. And then came a war, and then came independence and a war. So I don't think it's right to start Israeli history after the Holocaust.
Okay.
I think that's just wrong. And let me just one last thing. We're talking about Gaza. Gaza is not the West Bank. Gaza is a piece of land that Israel doesn't want, has got no pretensions to it, hasn't claimed,
but
doesn't want to be there.
And locks people in,
you know,
there.
But that's only since the rocket started. Freedom of access to Gaza before the rocket started.
All I can tell you, look, I mean, we're talking about, the average age, I think, in Gaza at the moment is 17.
Yes, 50%, I think, of the population of Gaza is under 18.
By the way, I've just got word that the latest news is that Hamas has agreed to a new 24-hour truce starting at 12.
It's good news from humanitarian purposes. But, absolutely. You know, you were talking earlier on about the need to focus in on this issue in between these bouts of really particularly horrific conflict. I can tell you that over the last 6 years since I've been in my particular role, the number of times that I found myself having conversations with representatives of the Israeli government, be it ambassadors or others, about the situation in Gaza, and they have been very, very troubling conversations. I mean, I've gone in and raised individual cases, humanitarian cases. I remember talking about the case of a mother of five who had terminal cancer, who desperately needed to be allowed to leave Gaza to get into Egypt for palliative care. They wouldn't allow her to leave because she was a security risk. She was almost dead. The number of cases like that we're dealing with on an ongoing basis, saying to an Israeli ambassador at one particular point, talking about the humanitarian crisis in Gaza, and the response was, we don't accept it's a humanitarian crisis, but we accept that the situation in Gaza is very difficult, and that's how it must be in order for Israel to be safe. I mean, that's a tacit acknowledgement, an explicit acknowledgement of collective punishment. And Israel is not entitled to collectively punish 1.8 million people by corralling them into an open refugee camp, a prison, and bombarding them.
Marion,
and in between the bombardments, denying them the very basics that they need to live any life of dignity.
Can I come back to you, Colm? How should the Israelis handle it? You're a military man.
Well, if you look at it from the military point of view, the policy of Israel always has been, if you kill one of us, we will kill 100 of you, and you have to take that as... So they do everything through might. Now, Israel will argue that it is surrounded basically by enemies.
It is.
And that in order to protect itself, it has to be superior militarily. And as long as they have big America behind them, they can speak with a degree of arrogance. I remember 20 years ago going into a shop in the old city of Jerusalem, and there was a T-shirt, and written on the T-shirt was, "Don't worry, America, Israel is behind you." And that to me is a degree of arrogance. I've seen the Israeli army operate in South Lebanon. I've actually seen them. And they go in, they cordon off an area, they take out who they want, and what they used to have was they had checkpoints on both sides of the village. They would go in to target a certain amount of houses. If anybody attempted to go out through those checkpoints, they were actually killed. That's the way they did it. I remember another famous case where I was in the town of Tyre, and a small child was playing with a football on the side of the road. An Israeli convoy passed by. Something happened. There was a noise, and the result of this was an Israeli soldier shot the boy, who was about 3 years of age. He was just kicking a football. And the report in the paper the following day was, the Israeli forces have killed a terrorist in Tyre. So we have found, and this is only my opinion, but I think most Irish military people who have served in places like Lebanon will say that the Israeli army operate with a great degree of arrogance. They are the dominant force.
But can I ask you the question? And I come back to the point If these things are being sent over by Hamas, however inefficient and useless they are, though they have killed people, what does a mighty power do against a very weak group of people who are all stashed in there in Gaza? Like, what do you do to stop them?
I agree it is extremely difficult and there's no easy solution to it, because if you look at it from the point of view of Israel, I am living and a guy next door is... If you take two people living together, one of them has the glass house in the bottom of his garden and his neighbour starts to throw pebbles at the glass house and then the pebbles turned into stones. Eventually, the guy who owns the glass house will go into the other guy's garden and hit him. This is what's happening. We should be crying out and saying to Hamas, as long as you fire a rocket into the sovereign state of Israel, you're asking for trouble. And it gives ammunition for Israel to retaliate with the might of its army.
But if it wanted to stop them without retaliating with the might of its army, which people find shocking, what do you do to stop them?
You have to try and persuade them. I mean, it has to be a peaceful means, because militarily Hamas don't have the might. Israel does.
And never
Israel
will.
Is willing. And never will. But Israel will continue to use its might on the grounds that we are defending our sovereign state.
Which they are.
Of course, I agree.
Could I just say
something? But it depends
here
on the word proportionate and indiscriminate. And they're the two words that are out of focus in this scenario.
Marion, I visited Israel and Palestine this year, back in late April, early May. And, you know, regardless, I think, of whether you are sympathetic to the Israeli side of the debate or the Palestinian one, what struck me most was just the disparity between how Israelis live and how Palestinians live between the two territories. If you are Palestinian, you know, let's say the West Bank, which hasn't been discussed much in this crisis, 47% of the West Bank is under Israeli control. If you are Palestinian and you live in the West Bank, you are extremely restricted in where you can travel. You're extremely restricted in where you can build, or if you can build at all. Most Palestinians are not allowed to build. Your home can be demolished under, you know, very questionable circumstances. You know, whether you have a right to education, you can't drill for water, your access to land is extremely limited. So if you just looked, if you forgot about the political context of this and just said in terms of human rights, in terms of basic economic and other rights, how do the two communities compare with each other? You would say it really is intolerable to what the Palestinians are living under in terms of all of the restrictions on their right to travel, on the right to move, on the right to a livelihood and so on, that there will sooner or later be revolution.
Would I have that point? But you just are the point. The number of suicide bombers have gone down.
Well, the number of suicide bombers in the short term may have gone down. I think what you're looking at is the escalation of regional, you know, pressures and forces that in the longer term, you cannot help but feel there is something very intractable about the Israeli-Palestinian situation. But there's also a sense that it is going to be, I think, the fulcrum of a much greater, wider regional threat for the rest of the world if we don't, if you know, good sense can't be brought to bear. We are very familiar with it, you know, how intractable political situations can be looking at Northern Ireland. But, you know, sometimes it does take external forces to use whatever leverage they have. And the difficulty at the moment is there's no leverage that can be used with the Israeli government because, unfortunately, the status quo, they are very, very, and I can understand the Israelis being as vigilant as they are. I think the threat that they have to live with in terms of you know, the threat of rocket fire and other, you know, maybe terrorist or fears of terrorism, they're very real, they're very legitimate, but something has to shift, something has to move.
Okay,
and if it doesn't,
Yaki,
the rest of the world
there
will end up paying.
I think that Deirdre has mentioned something here which hasn't really come up earlier and I think is possibly more relevant than everything else we've been talking about. I think it is wrong to even look at what's happening with all the horror that's happening in Gaza, to look at it in isolation, even to talk about the Israelis and Hamas. There's a much bigger picture, and it's a very worrying picture, and has actually, in my opinion, precious little to do with Israel. What's going on in the Middle East, what's going on in Syria and ISIS, inter-Arab rivalry, whether it's religious or in terms of power, regional powers. The rockets that are being sent over, that are being fired from Gaza to Israel, they're not rockets that are made in someone's backyard. These are Syrian rockets. These are Iranian rockets. In other words, thousands of rockets are getting into this tiny enclave. Someone's paying for it. And in other words, it's not just about Hamas deciding it wants to destroy Israel, which it does. It says so openly in its charter. Doesn't believe in peace talks, says that in its charter. But it's a bigger picture. There's other, Iran is the elephant in the room here.
Can I take that bigger picture, which includes Iran and Syria and the very worrying things and perhaps one would say crazy things that the West did in recent years as well. But that in the long term, and given the imagery that you say, it's all very shocking, but it doesn't give the full story, that in a peculiar way, Israel could be doing itself unbelievable long-term damage in terms of the rest of the world. Now, I know that when America is there for Israel, that one can feel very secure if you're Israeli. But that long term, that may not be the way it's going to be. There's going to be a shift in power all over the place. And indeed, what we'll be talking about later on to do with oil resources and what political outcomes there will be for that.
And America's
growing independence in terms of oil supplies, all of the above.
I think you're right. I think what you're saying is absolutely right. But then Israel has actually not ever had the quiet period that you're alluding to. From before independence, in independence and after independence, it's always been under attack. Now, one of the biggest enemies, Egypt, 30 years after Israel's independence, opted out of the military option, which was, for me, one of the greatest days in my life when Sadat came to Jerusalem. I couldn't believe it, had to pinch myself, and I thought, you know what, if that can happen, other miracles
can
happen.
And Jimmy Carter obviously was helpful in all of that as well.
I think we could debate that, but let's leave that to a historical debate. But what I'm saying is the shifts that you're talking about, at the moment, they are frightening. I mean, we don't realize actually what's going on in some of the places out there, and they are going to influence us quite apart from Gaza, quite apart from Israel. For Israel, being in a difficult neighborhood, that's nothing new. What's new is that who is the latest enemy that wants to attack us? And I think that when this is over, who knows where it's coming from next? And this is not just about Israel. I think the West is fast asleep about what's happening in Syria.
Colin?
Yeah, I agree actually with him, because if you look across the map of North Africa, if you look at the Middle East, you look at Syria, the rise of Islamic fundamentalism is quite considerable. It started with ISIS in Iraq and Syria. Now we're wondering where else. We had the crash that we all thought might have been a terrorist attack the other day in Mali. There's a war in Mali with Islamic fundamentalism. You have it right across from Tunisia with the Arab Spring, all the way across, and put all of these regions together. And I think it's a frightening scenario. And yes, I agree that Israel might at one stage have to look at this from afar and say, not alone are we surrounded by enemy, but the future is very dim. And it's something that the West probably doesn't realise, I think.
But just another point, that there was a very good analysis by somebody called Daniel Levy, who's an European commentator on the situation in the Middle East. And he points out that what appears to be Netanyahu's strategy at the moment is to maintain the status quo, that somehow with this sort of dominant military position and economic position, that Israel is sort of holding its ground and that it will continue to do so and keep Gaza and, you know, the Palestinians in a disempowered position. And he also pointed out that there's no way that they can win. He said, you know, no matter what they do, the best they can hope for is that things stay, the Palestinians, is that things stay just as they are. Or if they escalate anything, or they, you know, for example, give support to Hamas and so on, things get much, much worse. So he's saying there's no good option being placed on the table. Like, the long-term strategy of Israel is not that intelligent. It's a sort of a hoping that somehow through military dominance it can preserve the status quo, which it won't be able to because of regional changes. So if Israel, you know, can be you know, encouraged, particularly with international pressure on it at the moment, to think this through more sensibly and to think in the longer term, if there is this rise of radical, you know, Islamic tendencies in the Middle East and so on, and if American's influence in the region is diminishing, what is a safe and secure way to pursue their economic and their political future as a state, as an Israeli state? And I think really that is what needs to be looked at right now, because if it's ignored, the status quo will not be maintained. That's one thing that's very, very obvious if you visit that part of the world. It's not going to be maintained. So they really need to start looking at that. And I think that's where the international community comes in, and the international fora such
as... But one of the things that I was listening to a broadcast from Israel, and you know that the Israelis believe, this was within Israel, that they've been condemned so many times by the United Nations that they kind of just expect that from the United Nations. So that becomes ineffectual.
But in a way, if you write off the United Nations, and I mean, we have to say America also writes off these, there's many forces.
The invasion of Iraq.
The right-wing forces in America write off the UN as well. We are nowhere if we don't have a good international forum where the international community can gather and try and agree norms for behaviour.
The problem is right now we don't. I mean, the UN, if you look at the UN Security Council, for instance, I mean, the UN Security Council has failed woefully on a whole range of conflicts over the last 5 or 10 years. And it's exactly because permanent members like the US, China, Russia get to exercise the veto without any, without even ever even having to be accountable for the reasons why, without having to even explain why. But so the UN Security Council is meant to guarantee peace and security. Actually, it's a highly politicalized fora where the permanent members act purely in their vested interests with little regard for ongoing concerns.
And if you take Iraq unilaterally.
Exactly. But one of the points, just very quickly on the whole question of the rise of Islamic fundamentalism, I mean, one of the things I think we have to make sure we include in this discourse, who have been the majority of the victims of the rise of Islamic fundamentalisms? Muslim populations in the areas where they've risen. So, you know, whilst we're inclined to focus on this as a threat to the wider world, it's about time that we started to care about the impact of these kinds of conflicts on the particular populations in the countries where they lived. And with that regard, I think one of the key solutions is governments, states, have to start to respect the laws that they wrote. And where states or heads of states breach law, they must be held to account. And that means we need significant reform. And that means that Israel or Hamas or Assad or ISIS or George Bush or anybody else who's responsible for war crimes must be prosecuted and held accountable.
Hold on a minute now. They're all over there. And even if you take what happens in The Hague, it's very often countries from the Southern Hemisphere or... Tony Blair and George Bush did acting unilaterally.
That's why I just said George Bush.
I mean, nobody has ever suggested that they be hauled before.
Yes, excuse me.
Well, not successful. I can tell you
that Amnesty International colleagues in Canada tried to have George Bush arrested under universal jurisdiction when he visited there, which is why one of the reasons why a visit was called short. We're calling repeatedly. We're calling again. I'll say it again here today. We want states, including Ireland, to exercise their responsibility under the principle of universal jurisdiction. And when a person enters this state who's responsible, where there's a prima facie case that they're guilty of war crimes, Ireland has a responsibility to prosecute that person for those crimes. All states have those responsibilities. And until impunity ends, states and others, be it Israel, be it Hamas, be it Bush, be it anybody, will continue to perpetrate these violations.
Yeah, but the history of the world is really that might is right, isn't it?
I mean, and that's what we have to change. And that's what the code of international humanitarian and human rights law that has been developed over the last number of years was meant to change.
Ursula, you were trying to get in there a couple of times.
Yeah, just at the end, because I do think that no matter what we do in this conflict, we have to sort of go back to that human lives, you know, the way are lost every day, and even self-defense to a certain extent, to say, yes, we have to do something, that's fine. But in our modern world, to really feel that a war can solve something, yeah, and that we're really saying, oh yeah, that's self-defense, and now we go in and 1,000 people can just die like that, I don't think we can allow that as an international community.
How do we stop it?
Well, I do think with more international resolutions, and that people, statesmen, feel more responsible, that they have to be accountable for what they do.
But if you take what's happened in Syria, which originally the West were invited to get involved in and all that, what's the death toll there now?
200,000.
About 200,000, but I think one of the concerns there is that who would the West be supporting in the war in Syria?
Very good question.
That's the problem.
Yeah.
Because as it turns out now, a lot of the opposition
population in Syria have been fundamentalist Islamists coming from all over the world.
So including
the West,
Europe.
Including Europe, of course. And that's also a threat now that...
Including Ireland, including Britain.
Yeah, the Great Britain has, that they're fearful that there's a lot of young people from Britain going to join these wars. You see it in Africa, you have it in Nigeria with Boko Haram, you had it in the in Algeria, Libya, right across the north of Africa. It is a growing problem. There's no doubt about that.
Could I just make a quick point there? I think back to the UN again, you know, we seem to have sort of admitted that the UN is a very flawed, you know, forum or institution or whatever, but it's all we have. And in an increasingly globalised world, we need it to work well. So really the reform of the UN is one of the things that people generally should support. We tend to think, oh, the UN, it's far from us, and international issues, well, they don't really affect us here in Ireland or in the UK or whatever. They will and they do. And so therefore it is something we should put pressure on in terms of Ireland's foreign policy, is that we really work towards, you know, being part of the reform of the UN structures. And the second point is just around, I think, a point that you were making there about, trying to think about the
I'll go back to you in a second.
Yeah, do, because it's just...
Yes, yeah, you wanted to come in.
Yeah, actually, Ireland is one of the places in the world where I think they are more positive about the UN than many other countries. There's much less cynicism in Ireland about the United Nations. I think there's a history for that. It's to do with the Irish forces, Irish personalities being involved in the top levels of the United Nations. So I think Ireland actually is in a good place to be talking about reform of the United Nations. Now, I don't know my figures here, but there's something a little wrong with an international organization that, if you look at the number of resolutions against Israel and compare it to the number of resolutions against the rest of the world, including China and including all the other places where there are one or two abuses of human rights, it is so ridiculous. I mean, it is totally, we're talking about like 50 anti-Israel to 4 for the rest of the world. When you get that sort of figure, it's not... it's no wonder that many people will look at the United Nations and say, well, as you just said, that forum isn't working. What is? Now, I'm not saying that there's no hope, but I agree with Colin that everything is built in there to be totally skewed so that there's no real, almost ever...
Well, hang on, I didn't say everything was a build-up, and I was talking specifically about the UN Security Council and how it operates in terms of its mandate. And I have to say that one of the most depressing things about some of the conversations, particularly over the last couple of weeks in this, is the kind of appalling whataboutery we've seen. You know, when the United Nations...
As if we didn't know as well from 90 miles up the road.
When the United Nations holds a state to account on the basis of its human rights record, it's examining its human rights record. And one of the things I wish states, including Israel, and indeed some people in Ireland might do, is they'd answer the specific questions that put to them about their conflict and stop saying, well, what about Iran or what about this one? If you break the law, you break the law. If you're in breach of your international obligations, you're in breach of them. You need to be accountable for your breach and not simply try to deflect to talk about somebody else. We've seen this week the value of the United Nations. Its commentary on human rights in Ireland this week is incredibly important, and I've been delighted this week to see the degree of engagement that there's been with the report of the Human Rights Committee on Ireland, on issues like women's rights in particular and other issues. It's been remarkable how much attention and influence these kinds of reports are having in Ireland and upon the Irish political system, but more importantly on Irish society.
Right.
It's a really important body.
Just to come back to the point that I couldn't remember, it was about economic sanctions. There was a very good point made this morning, I think, in the Sunday Independent in an article about the fact that in the globalised world now, what seems to be happening is that there's been a shift from the use of military power to the use of economic power, and that at this moment in time, the West has more economic power because most of the Western capital markets are those on which, let's say, Russia and other powers depend, particularly if they're exporting oil and other forms of energy and so on. So that's the case at the moment. It may not always be the case that the West is in a dominant position economically, but what we are likely to see now is that major powers, instead of implementing wars or engaging in wars, may be more inclined then to use economic sanctions, and how they are used will also be important.
Yeah, or maybe economic assistance. I mean, if you take the level of unemployment both in the West Bank and in Gaza, and if Europe took it as a project to say we're going to solve the problem of of engagement.
And
employment.
How will it do that in Gaza, seeing as it can't, you can't actually send any materials into Gaza because of the blockade? How are you going to have any kind of economic activity in Gaza when all activity is completely suppressed?
This is
by
one
the
of
blockade.
The problems that has affected Hamas, because the Egyptian, when the Muslim Brotherhood were overruled by the military, the new government in Egypt closed the Rafah Gate. And that was the means by which the people from Gaza were getting in their supplies, including weapons and rockets, admittedly. But when that was closed off, Hamas lost an awful lot of its support. In addition to that, when Hamas went and against Assad, Iran stopped supporting Hamas as well. So Hamas was out on a limb for a certain while, and Hamas needed to get back in, and the only way it was going to do it was to thought they were going to have this national government with Fatah, which hasn't worked. So Hamas has found itself in a pretty difficult position. And what they do then is what they've done before, is they'll go and they'll hit Israel with their rockets. It seems to be senseless what they're doing, because it gives legitimacy to the Israelis. Yeah. So hard to know what the solution is.
Well, and I don't suppose it's going to be, but I mean, I think the point that Ursula said is that war doesn't do it, and it will have to end at some stage, and the status quo is going to know. Anyway, we're going to have to take a break. With us in studio this morning, Deirdre De Burke, Colm Doyle, Ursula Tipp, Yanky Fackler and Colm O'Gorman.
Podcast The Marion Finucane Show at rte.ie/radio.
Welcome back to the programme. Now, we spent a lot of time on that, obviously, because it's one of the biggest stories internationally today. But let's come back home and look at some of the headlines here again. Politicians lobbied HSE 21,000 times on medical cards. And there is another headline in there. Medicine up to 27 times dearer in Ireland than Britain. Who'll I go to on that? The whole purpose of the original amalgamation of the HSE, which I know people love to slaughter, was to take politics out of people's rights medically.
Well, what's funny, of course, about that story, not funny, but what's tragic about that story is that in the same piece, this is on the front of the Post by Michael Brennan on the medical cards piece, in the same piece it's made clear that, you know, TDs have no power to get people medical cards if they're over the income limits. And yet, there's still the belief that they do. And yet, TDs and politicians will still engage on behalf of constituents, knowing that they have no power, knowing that. So it's almost the presentation of the pretense of power or influence in order to continue to do the favour that might support. It ties in a little bit with
but including the Minister for Health. This article, according to
the
my
former friend, Minister for Health.
Former Minister for Health. Between January and June this year, his office phoned the HSE 150 times and sent 57 emails with medical card queries.
Yeah, I mean, it is extraordinary. It ties in very well with a great piece by Pat Leahy in the Sunday Business Post, where he's talking about, you know, the defining characteristic of the practice of politics in Ireland is in the effort to obtain and retain power. And actually, that very often the defining characteristic of power in Ireland is the pretense of power, unless you hold executive power, because the only place where political power exists in Ireland is with the executive. We have a very weak parliamentary system. It's still the case, despite the political revolution of 2011, that most of the power rests in with the executive. Indeed, some would say that even some of the executive power rests within a subset of the executive when you look at the Economic Council. But Pat makes the really important point that this is because our political system is an expression of our political culture. And what we've seen is a demand from people to change the system without the underlying political culture undergoing any change itself. The expectations and demands of people expressed through our electoral system remain largely the same. In other words, 21,000 people will still go looking for favours from politicians.
The cost issue is mind-blowing. The details here in the Sunday Business Post of specific medications that are used here in Ireland that are costing the HSE 20 euro, where the same thing is paid 1.56 euro by the NHS for the same drug. Something is absolutely bizarre and crazy here. That's mad. 20 times, that's mad. Mad.
Colm?
No, I'm just remarking on Colm's point there. I mean, part of the job of a politician, a local TD, is to look after his constituents. And they will make any representations they can. Whether they will succeed or not, I think, is actually beside the point. Because I know in my career, I often would get a phone call from a TD looking to do a favour for a particular soldier. And you'd say, well, I don't think we can do this. They'd say, well, look, it really doesn't matter. I just want to be able to tell him I phoned. So a lot of them, and it's to retain a vote, it's to stay in their power. I often feel that politicians or TDs, but this is my own private view, is that when you become a TD, you should have no influence whatsoever in anything local. You're now a national legislator and you should put all your dedication into that. Now, I know that will go against the grain of a lot of people, but certainly, I mean, this is what a TD does. He has his clinic, he'll have 20 people outside, he'll take a few notes and he'll say, I'll make a phone call for you. I don't know.
Well, let's be a little bit fair here as well. I mean, the job of an elected representative is to elect the people who is to represent the people who elected
Correct.
Them. The point is that they should be representing them or engaging with them on issues where they both have power, influence, and the capacity to change things. It's about appropriate representation.
But you know, I remember doing again a program about somebody really annoyed who had gone for a planning permission and got it. Properly by applying for planning permission, doing all that, and got it. And 3 days later, gets a note from the local politician to say, "I was delighted to be able to help you."
I had a brief little flirtation with the political system back in about 2007, and I can remember talking to somebody in Wexford at the time who was telling me that, well, the lists now for people who've been granted social housing before they're made public are going out to all of the local representatives. And exactly that. Every single local representative sent a letter in an Oireachtas envelope, by the way, which we would have paid for, to say, I'm glad I was able to help, whether they had any contact with the person or not. And they're all hoping that when the letter lands, the person might not remember who they spoke to, or they'll be somehow associated with, and there it runs. And that's why, actually, I mean, the kind of political reform that we really need in this country is a reform to set out very clearly what are the rights that people in this country have.
But we've been talking about
that
for the last.
But just to say, I mean, the clientele system we have been giving out about, and we talk a lot about political reform, but we're all addicted to it. And, you know, the clientele system doesn't just exist because politicians
exactly,
like doing things that
point.
Way. They do it because we're a small country, we've a very tightly knit social fabric, we know an awful lot. And bump into local politicians, national politicians and so on. And we kind of expect, oh, if there's something wrong or my mother needs this, something like that, I go to somebody, I ask them something, oh, he'll do something for he's good, you know. And that's how our politicians prove themselves to us, because they care, he cared, he did that for me.
But it's not so.
But it, Marion, it unfortunately is to a large extent true that a lot of us do a kind of expect, and it's especially when our own needs are like when it's our planning or our relative that needs to get, I don't know, pushed up the waiting list or whatever, that it does seem to be something that we expect and that we'll all have to kind of restructure our thinking.
Well,
and
can I go to the two people from other
countries? Like
that. How does it work in Germany?
Okay, it wouldn't be working on the same scale as in Ireland, but I suppose it's a much larger country. You know, a country with 80 million people, where obviously the parliamentarians, especially the parliamentarians now in the national parliament in Berlin, they are far, much further away from their constituencies than it would ever happen in Ireland. But yes, they would also have constituencies offices in their area would try to do something. And you can see it sometimes when ministers then build a special whatever park or something and make sure that it goes into their area.
Okay.
You know, so there is a bit of that, but it's less, but probably less because of human nature. Is probably it's natural to do it a bit this way. I wouldn't support it. I don't think it's right, because I think national politicians should look after national politics.
And in Israel?
Israel doesn't have constituencies. And so it's at the local level where this sort of thing, and of course it goes on. You know, I know the mayor, I know the mayor's assistant, and I'll put in a word, and is it effective? Isn't it effective? We don't know, but, you know, not a few politicians have found themselves in jail because they went too far with doing favours. And that's the sign of a healthy society. It doesn't make me comfortable, but that's what happens.
Right. OK, well, I don't know. On the question of the cost of the medical cards, that's not the cost of the medical cards, the cost of the medicines. We've been talking about that since God was a child. And nothing seems to change there either.
Amazing.
Anyway, what can you do? We, at this point, it's midday and we have to go to the newsroom and Clodagh Walsh.